Well, good morning. I'm happy to be with you. Time sure flies. I mean, Mike got up there and he started speaking. I think you started at 9 o'clock, and here it is 10:30. And man, I had no idea that he had talked quite that long. I'm Ralph Walker, and I'm here for your meeting, and I'm very happy to be here and really glad we're going to be discussing the subjects that we're going to discuss. We're looking at lives of little people in the Bible, and that's not a reference to stature. That's a reference to lesser known characters, the people that we don't really see very much of, but in what we see of them, there is a volume of information that's valuable to us. There are a lot of those that I have, and you chose some of the ones from that list and then allowed me to choose one other, just saying, give us one more, and I said, this is the one we'll do. So I'm very glad to be here. It's been a while since I've been here. My last meeting with you had three aspects of it that were they're unforgettable for me. First of all, I arrived and I forgot my Bible. I had been debating which Bible to bring. I had a brand new one, and I wondered whether I should bring my new one or my old one, and I kept debating it, and then never picked up either one. So I came here and used your pew Bibles, and I would call out not only the verse reference, but I would also call the page number, and I got to liking that so much. That's what we do at my home congregation all the time now. I don't preach from the pew Bibles, but I always call out the page number, and visitors love it because visitors don't know their Bibles very well. And when you call out a reference, we're going to Matthew chapter 4, verse 10. By the time you've read it and moved on to the next passage, a lot of your visitors are just getting there. So I like calling out the page numbers, and we do that. All of our preachers call out the page numbers. That was the first thing that happened. It was good for me. That was a good serendipitous experience. The second was, I was coming from the airport with Jeremy, who was bringing me from the airport, and he said, so here's your schedule, and here's what you'll be doing. You know, Sunday you're doing this, and Monday, and then Tuesday you'll be eating with these people. And then I said, what about Wednesday? And he said, meeting ends on Tuesday. And I said, no, the meeting goes through Wednesday. And he said, no, it's Tuesday. He was so firm about it, I began to question myself. And I said, pull over. And we pulled over to the side of the road, and I went and got my notes, and there was a note from Jeremy. It said, meeting runs Sunday through Wednesday. And he said, oh, I didn't know. We only had you down to Tuesday. I said, well, you got me till Thursday, so I'm going to be here. And so we decided to just extend the meeting into Wednesday night. I went ahead and preached my lesson. But the third thing was the tragedy. I was here for 9/11. I was staying with the Grushons, and my wife woke me up that Tuesday morning and said, turn on the TV, you will not believe what's happening. And so I was with you actually longer than I intended to be with you. Debbie finally got me to an airport where I could get home a couple of days later. But that was an unforgettable experience. We got together that night here and prayed, and I delivered the lesson, and we were shell-shocked by what had happened to our country. I'm really glad to be back with you, though. I hope that we won't have any repetition. I do have my Bible, and I'm pretty sure that we're going through Wednesday on this meeting, and we're all agreed on that aspect of it. And if we can refrain from any national catastrophes like we had last time, then it will have undone all three of those things that we did during that week together. I preach, and I serve as a shepherd with a congregation at Henderson Boulevard in South Tampa. And I've been there now since 1994, the latter part of 94. I moved down to Tampa to begin work as the alumni director and the public relations director at Florida College, where I went to school, where Mike went to school, where Mike's younger brother, Debbie, was there. Mike's younger brother, Jim, was a classmate of mine at Florida College. And I worked there for 19 years and recently went back to full-time preaching, and that's what I do now. I serve my home congregation there. So I bring you greetings from the Sunshine State. I bring you greetings from your brothers and sisters at the Henderson Boulevard Church of Jesus Christ. Most of all, I bring you greetings in the name of the Lord Jesus. It is His name that has brought us here. It is His work in saving us that has made us into a family of God. And it is by His authority and permission that I'm allowed to preach the gospel of Jesus. So I pray that you'll hear what I have to say that comes from the Word, and we're going to share in that this morning. We'll begin our study with looking at a lesser known character. When I give you names, you don't have to answer out loud, but I'm going to give you some names of people. Tell me what characteristic or action you associate those people with. And I'll give you the first one. With Moses, it might be the plagues or the Ten Commandments. With Abraham, you probably would think faith. He's the father of the faithful. Maybe a little more varied on this one. If I said Eve, some of you might think sin, the sin in the Garden of Eden. Some of you might think fruit, because that's what she picked. Some of you might think mother of all living. That is what she was, the mother of all living. If I said Judas, we're all back on the same page, I think. We'd all say traitor, the betrayer of our Lord. And on the same page, I think again, if I said Thomas, the word that I think probably comes to your mind is doubting. Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas. We remember him because of two incidents that occurred in the book of John. There are only two incidents in the life of Thomas other than his listing as one of the 12 apostles. Both of them are found in John, and the one that we most often remember is the last one, where he said, as he came into the room, and the disciples said, the Lord had appeared among us, and Thomas said, unless I stick my finger in his palms and stick my hand in his side, I will not believe. And there's Jesus right there. And Jesus says, reach your hand out. Thomas says, my Lord and my God. Great statement. My Lord and my God. And it's at that point Jesus says, no, you saw and believed. That's good. But blessed more are those who have never seen yet believe. So we call him Doubting Thomas because he said, I just can't believe it unless I see it. Now, I think I could go into an entire lesson on the impropriety of calling him Doubting Thomas based on that. I mean, the other disciples hadn't believed until they saw. None of them believed until Jesus appeared before them. And so it's, I think, normal that Thomas would say, I need to see. I need to put my hands on him to make sure that he's not a ghost or that you guys aren't hallucinating in that situation. But what's really interesting is there's one other incident with Thomas. It's only one sentence, but I think it defines Thomas in a different way. It's not Doubting Thomas I want to talk to you about this morning. I want to talk to you about Definite Thomas. The guy who made a really positive statement about his relationship with the Lord. Other than mentioning him in the listing of the apostles, Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, the disciples are listed, and Thomas is always found in that listing. But aside from that, the very first mention of Thomas is found in John chapter 11. If you've got your Bibles, and we'll turn there, that's where I'm going to be. John chapter 11. And the statement that I want to key on is somewhat eclipsed by the events of John chapter 11, because this is the chapter where Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. And we move to that tomb so quickly because we want to see that scene and remember the power of Jesus in calling Lazarus from the tomb. Lazarus, come forth. We want to get to that part of the story, and we miss something that happened much earlier in that story. So I want to begin with you in 11 chapter 1. Now, a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. That's an odd way of putting that, but Lazarus is the brother of Mary and Martha. He's not just from the village of Mary and Martha, he's from the same household. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother, Lazarus, was sick. So the sister sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Hey, pause here for a minute. I'm going to run through a couple of points to bring us up to speed on the width and breadth of this story. When they send word, Lazarus is sick, I'm sure he doesn't have a cold, or he's running a mild fever, or he's just got nausea because he ate something that didn't agree with him. When they send that word, it's serious. They're sending word to Jesus because they're very concerned about him. So when we see sick, he is very sick. He's nigh unto death sick. He's been sick. I mean, this is something that allows them to get the word to Jesus about that situation. So it's not he bumped his head and he hasn't become conscious again. He is declining in his health and they're very concerned about that. When Jesus heard this, he said, now he's not there with them. He hears it. They've sent a messenger to him. When he heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Okay, two more things about that. It's interesting to me that Jesus makes that statement to the disciples, and I'm sure they breathe a sigh of relief. Jesus knows. He says, this is not the end in death. That's not this. So they think, okay, he's going to get better. And that will be pointed out in a moment. But the other thing is that the writer tells us here in verse 5, now Jesus loved Martha and Mary. He's telling him that because Jesus isn't going to act like he loves them. I want to say something about that. You know, we sometimes judge people by the way we think they ought to be loved, and it may not be real love, what we think should be. So we see parents perhaps disciplining children, and we say, boy, they don't love them. Look, they're harsh with them. When in fact, what those parents may be doing is a greater sign of love than what we might recommend they do. Or we may treat somebody in the family in a hard way. Maybe we've got a brother or a sister or parents or children who've run up insurmountable debts, and they've done that very foolishly, and then they come for help, and the parents or the siblings or the children say, we're not going to help with that. We've warned you about this. That's tough love, but that's love. That wakes people up sometimes. And what Jesus is about to do in this situation does not look like he cares very much for them. So the writer tells us, now I want to tell you up front, Jesus loved them. So what you see in this story has to be filtered through that. You have to take whatever you see and remember, in the beginning, Jesus loved them. I say that often about God's working in our lives. Somebody will say, well, it doesn't look like God cares very much for these people. I say, God does all things well. All things well. You've got to start with that premise. He is all-knowing and he does all things well. And so whatever it looks like is going to end up being good, even though at the time it may not appear to be that way. So, when he heard he was sick, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Jesus just goes about his business. I want you to picture that in terms that we could understand. This messenger comes in to Jesus and says, hey, Lazarus is sick. Jesus says, okay. And he says, no, I mean, he's really sick. Mary and Martha sent me to you. I think they want you to come because he's nigh unto death. And Jesus said, I appreciate the message. He turns to the disciples and says to them, because they're looking worried. And he says, this is not unto death. This is not going to end in death. Okay, guys? So calm down. And they all breathe and they think, okay, well, let's go see him because he's really sick. And then Jesus says, now, what was on the agenda today? What were we doing today? Oh, we were supposed to go over and preach to these people. Okay, well, let's go. Well, Lord, what about Lazarus? Well, we've got our agenda. For the next 2 days, we're doing what we were doing. And then after this, he said to the disciples, then he says, okay, let's go to Judea. Now let's go. He doesn't even say in specific terms, although it may be expanded from what we hear here. He may have said, let's go to Judea. It's time to go see Lazarus. But he says, let's go to Judea. And then the disciples said, Rabbi, if I may paraphrase them, Rabbi, it was one thing when you were going to see Lazarus because he was sick, but you said it's not going to end in death. And why take chances in going to see him if he's going to get better? Because they said the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. Are you going there again? Lord, that's a dangerous place for you. That's not a good place to go. They said they were going to stone you. They were trying to stone you when you got away last time. You don't want to go back there. Not if you don't have to. If you said Lazarus is getting better, it's not going to end in death, then why go? Why risk that? And Jesus then says this kind of cryptic statement. Are there not 12 hours in the day? I got to tell you, if you and I were disciples of Jesus, our brains would hurt trying to keep up with him. I'm serious. Our brains would hurt. What does that have to... We just said, don't go to Judea, they're going to kill you. And then you start this, are there not 12 hours in a day? What does that have to do with this? If anyone walks in the day, he doesn't stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone stumbles in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. Now the disciples are still wrestling with that. What does that mean? Where did that come from? Maybe that's in the Proverbs Mike talked about today. I don't know. They're wrestling with that, and Jesus says, after this he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. Now he's not gotten further word about Lazarus, but he says, our friend Lazarus, he's fallen asleep. I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep. Now the disciples hear that, and remember, they're filtering this, rightly so, don't say dumb disciples. They're filtering it through his earlier statement, this will not end in death. So he says, he's fallen asleep. They interpret that, oh good, he's kind of, you know, we do that today medically. We will, sometimes doctors will create a medically induced comatose state so that somebody can recover. We do that. And this is not what he's saying, that Lazarus has gone into a coma, but he's saying, this is good. Lazarus is asleep, the disciples think. Oh, he's asleep, that's good. He's going to get better. He's now gone to sleep. And he's okay. And the disciples said, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he's going to recover. That's good. Why did you say we got to go back if he's asleep? And then Jesus had spoken of his death, verse 13 says. They thought he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus then said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I'm glad for your sakes that I wasn't there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. That must have shocked the disciples. Think about that. Didn't he just say 2 days ago, this will not end in death? Did I hear him wrong? Didn't he say that? This will not end in death? And now he says, Lazarus is dead. You know, the disciples are putting the best possible light on. He's asleep. That's good. He'll get better. No, I need to tell you. Lazarus is dead. Jesus hasn't gotten that word. He knows that. Across the distance of time and geography, Jesus knows Lazarus is expired. He hasn't even gotten a word from the messengers yet. He knows. All right, now, picturing this, remember this. Two things about this whole setup that are really important for the next statement. Jesus doesn't seem to be, to some, in control. He said he wouldn't die, now he's dead. And he said he wasn't going to go, but now he's going. And if he goes to die. Because they're going to kill him when he gets to Judea. That would be the normal way of interpreting all of this. If you and I were the disciples, I think we'd be totally confused at this point. I say that, and I posit that to you because of what happens here. Therefore, verse 16, Thomas, who is called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, so that we may die with him. I want to suggest just a couple of things, two things about Thomas in this passage. First of all, I want you to hear the resignation of a realist. Thomas doesn't say, we might. He doesn't say, let's go, we may die with him. He says, that we may die. He is absolutely convinced if they go to Judea, they're going to die. Not just Jesus, but all of them. They will die. Now, you know, it's one thing for me to say to you this morning, come follow Jesus, but know this. If you follow Jesus, it may result in your physical death. It's another thing to say, come follow Jesus and know this. In our culture and in our setting and where we are right now, following Jesus is almost surely going to result in your death. So come forward while we stand and sing. Who do you think's coming? Who's going to come? A disciple like Thomas. A man like Thomas. Let us go, that we may die with him. I think if I were one of the other disciples, I would have hated Thomas's statement. Because first of all, I said, look, you want to go, go. Don't make it us. You put us all on the spot by this. But also the courage that he demonstrates, that the other disciples are concerned about Jesus dying. Oh, don't you go, Lord. Don't you go back there. They're going to stone you. Thomas says, we'll all die with him, okay? Let's all go down together. If I were one of the other disciples, I'd have wanted Jesus to look away so I could punch him. You know, come here, Thomas, I got something for you. You know, because he's really put them all on the spot by this statement. Let us go that we may die with him. You know, Jesus spoke openly of the potential death for those who followed him. He starts it very simply in the Sermon on the Mount when he gives that last beatitude. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And he says, blessed are you. You. He wants to make sure that we understand that's not some other group, that's us. Blessed are you when men revile you and say all manner of evil against you unjustly for my name's sake. You're blessed if that happens to you. I'm amazed that the very first full sermon that we have offered by Jesus begins with that message. We sometimes say, you know, people have to hear the hard things. They got to hear them later. They can't take those things early on. Jesus opens his sermon with that statement. Blessed are the poor in spirit, the hungering. And blessed are those who are persecuted. But then you move on to Matthew chapter 10, and he gets really pointed. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus lays it all out. What does it mean to follow him? Listen, folks, these are eternal statements. That's not just for the people who lived in Jesus' day. Chapter 10, beginning in verse 17, beware of men. They'll hand you over to the courts. They'll scourge you in their synagogues. Scourging is a horrible form of punishment. I mean, it's whipping the backs with leather thongs. They will scourge you. And then he goes down and he says, you'll be brought before governors and kings as a testimony. When they hand you over, don't worry. It is not you who speak, but it's the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. And then this in verse 21, brother will betray brother to death. And a father, his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You know, I'm going to tell you, this is not a lesson about Christianity and Islam. But we're hearing things about how Islamic militants are prosecuting and persecuting people who claim to have faith in Jesus Christ. And we hear those stories sometimes about children who betray their parents, and their parents are taken off to prison or killed. Or parents turning their children over. I saw a movie not too long ago, an actual portrayal of the life of a young girl who became a follower of Jesus Christ in her own way. I may not agree with what she did, but she was claiming to follow Jesus. And her father beat her with his fists and kicked her out of the house on the porch. And you watch that and you go, this is horrible that this is happening. But I want you to know, that's what Jesus promised. Jesus promised that would happen to some. And when we see these beheadings that are taking place, you know, honestly, I'm not trying to make light of that at all. I'm not trying to treat that tritely. It's a horrible thing to be executed in any way. But a beheading is a pretty swift way of dying. Not all Christians had that blessing of dying quickly. Many of them were crucified or burned at the stake. That's not an easy way to die. And then the Lord goes on. He continues. He says, you will be hated by all, verse 22. And then verse 28, do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul. And if I heard Jesus there, I'd say, well, wait, would you back up and say that again? They're going to kill us? And then he goes on. And in verse 34, he says, do not think I came to bring peace. I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. And he says in verse 38, he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who's found his life will lose it. He who's lost his life for my sake will find it. Lost his life for my sake. Now, I realize there's a symbolic, an ethereal explanation of that, but in the context of this passage, I think he's talking literally. People who lose their lives for my sake, they're going to find it again. Don't you worry. Don't fear the people who can kill your body. Fear the one who can kill your soul in hell. So here are the kinds of statements that we hear from Jesus saying, you may die. What I love about Thomas is he may be the first disciple to actually recognize that possibility. The other disciples don't talk in that way. I know Peter pulls a sword to try to defend Jesus in just a short while. He'll do that. And that's certainly noble on his part. But where was Peter in the next couple of hours? Denying his Lord. And fleeing with the others. So here's Thomas making this statement. It's the resignation of a realist. He understands following Christ might result in the loss of everything I have and everything I am. Is it worth it? Well, I hope you think it is. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's a fascinating individual and lost his life as a martyr for his cause when he opposed the Nazis in Germany, said, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Now, there's a symbolic sense in that. We die to ourselves, and we bury that in the waters of baptism. But I'm going to tell you something else. The realistic understanding of what Jesus says is, some of us are going to go to our physical graves because we call Jesus Lord. You ready for that? Well, the only way you can be ready for that is to understand what it means to follow Jesus. What benefits and blessings there are in that great action. The resignation of a realist. I love Thomas there. There's no doubt in this man. Let us go that we may die with him. And that leads me to the second point. The relationship of a real disciple. A real disciple doesn't turn back when the going gets tough. Not a real disciple. I had teachers in school. I was math challenged. I was not good in math, not good in sciences because I wasn't good in math. And teachers would tell me, Ralph, you can get this. And I thought, I don't want to. I just can't get this. I mean, I thought math was one of those things. I had preferred it if it, you started an equation and then you said something like, and then a miracle occurred and the answer's there. That would have made me happy in that situation. I wasn't good at that. But I had a couple of teachers that I still remember who challenged me to go farther than I thought I could go, wanted me to walk with them along the path of learning that would cost me more than I thought at the time I was willing to pay. I went because of them. They drew me. And I love that Thomas says this about Jesus. You know, let us go that we may die with him. Not for him. With him. I've watched both versions of the movie about the Alamo. The John Wayne version and then the more recent version that was done. And I got to tell you, and I've been to the Alamo. And you stand there. And there is something in me that says it would have been noble to die with those men. To lose my life standing next to Davy Crockett. Or to be in the room with Jim Bowie as the Mexicans came in and slaughtered him. To die with that man. To die with William Travis. That, to die with heroes, with noble men who are fighting for a cause. That's not bad. It's not a bad way to go from this life. There's a phrase that's found in the Old Testament pretty frequently, and it has both a literal meaning, has a symbolic meaning. It's this phrase, and he slept with his fathers. He slept with his fathers. Not too long ago, Mike and Debbie were on a trip with us, and Mike spoke so eloquently about this idea, this concept of the great people who went before us in the faith. And that when we visit their tombstones and their grave sites, it inspires us in a great way to follow the Lord in a deeper way than we ever thought. Because we are in the company of great people. To sleep with your fathers is not only to say they put him in the grave near where his ancestors were. But it says he slept with the ones that he followed through his life. That's what it means. That's a great thought. Can you die with Jesus? Can you do that? Can you sleep with your fathers? The faith of our fathers. Holy faith. We will be true to thee till death. That's a great cause. And I love the way Thomas makes that statement. Let us go that we may die with him. He's not dying alone. Guys, I'm not letting it happen. And you shouldn't either. We're going with him and we will die with him. Death before disloyalty seems to be Thomas's thought. I will not betray him. I will not be disloyal to him. I want to go where he goes. Why? Well, first of all, because Jesus offers a cause worth dying for. I read a story not too long ago, and I want to expand on it at some point because it's just a great illustration. It was about a veteran who went to a parade to watch a patriotic assembly of people, and he was missing an arm. He was a veteran, and somebody walked up to him, and they said, "How did you lose your arm?" And he said, "I didn't lose it. I gave it." Tell you something. Jesus didn't lose his life. What we're going to celebrate this morning in the supper of the Lord, he didn't lose his life. He gave it. There's a difference. There was an intent on Jesus' part, an intent on that soldier's part to give up what was necessary for a cause that they felt was worth dying for. Look at 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. I want to look at verses 12 through 16 with you. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, don't be surprised as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree, listen to this, to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, you keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you're reviled for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Now you make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or even a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. Have you been in this situation where one of two things happened? Either somebody challenged your God or your Lord Jesus, and you sat quiet because you didn't want to cause problems for yourself if you spoke up in what appeared to be a hostile group? Or you spoke up, and then you went and told your friends so that you could find somebody to comfort you in the pain that you were experiencing. If somebody came before us this morning and said, I lost my job. Well, how did that happen? I'm out of work. Job I've had for years. I'm out of work because I stood up for Jesus Christ. They were getting ready to have some kind of a celebration, and it was denigrating my Lord. And I said, that's not right. We shouldn't do that. And they fired me. What would be your reaction to that? I think many of us would react this way. Oh, that's terrible. Lord, that's so terrible. Do something to make this right. When in fact, I think what the Lord would say is, welcome to my club. Now you know. Now you know what I experienced to some small degree. But now you also know what it's like to follow me. Because it's easy to follow Jesus when it's all in the rose garden. It's all on the easy paths. It's all on the interstates. That's easy to follow Jesus. Not so easy to follow him when the way is steep and the roads are crooked and the day is gone and darkness has come and thunder and lightning are flashing. It's not always easy to follow him then. But that's what he wants. That's what he insists on. So in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, after this great listing of these people, in Hebrews chapter 11, in chapter 12, verse 1, it says, seeing then that we are surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses. What are those witnesses? What are they? They're people saying, we've been there. We know. We know. I don't need those witnesses when everything's going great. I need those witnesses when it's tough. When I'm trying to run this race with endurance that's set before me, that's when I need the witnesses to say, Ralph, we've been there. We know. It is time for you to prepare yourself to sleep with your fathers. It's better to die a hero than live a coward. Why? Because heroes die for causes. Something worth dying for. And then this last thought that may have been in Thomas's mind. I don't know that it was, but it certainly may have been. Well, if Jesus dies, why would we want to live? My father passed away a few years ago. My mother is still alive, and She enjoys a modicum of health, but there are times when I think if my mother were to articulate her real heart, she'd say, why do I want to go on living? The person who's the other half of my life is gone. Why would I want to live? She's a disciple of Jesus, so she knows that things are good for her on the other side of death, as it was my father's life. But if Jesus is gone and dies, why would we want to live beyond that anyway? I think Thomas may have been thinking in those terms. We've got this statement, final thoughts. Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, verses 3 and 4. You have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is our life, is revealed, you also will be revealed with Him in glory. He is our life. So if He's parted from us, as Thomas thought, in a very real, tangible way, a visceral way, if He goes and dies physically, why would we want to live? Let's go die with Him. And about the time that we say that, and say that with fervor and conviction, I think here's what Jesus says back. I am the resurrection and the life. No Jesus. If there's no Jesus, there's no life. There's no real life. There's only existence here and torment awaiting us. Thomas got things the other disciples didn't get. And I would ask you to reconsider. When you hear His name, before you utter the word doubting, choose whatever word you want. But for me, He is definite, Thomas. He knows exactly what He's living for and what's worth dying for. Thanks for listening. We'll stand adjourned for a few moments and let the classes come in.